Talk given Saturday, 9th September 1972. Let us start today with a little meditation. Let the body be at ease. And just let the whole organism, the psychophysical organism, be suffused with peace. Every one of us must be well aware of the increasing violence in the world. This violence, which has had one of its latest manifestations in the tragic murder that has taken place at the Olympic Games in Munich. There seems to be no field of human activity today which is left in peace. Everywhere, in all fields, violence is on the increase. A violence which utterly disregards the moralities as laid down in the religions of the world, which disregards whatsoever we have achieved in the way of right relationships between human beings in any and every society. This violence is one of the most disruptive forces today in our mental life, our psychical life. We must never imagine that we can keep away from it, out of it. If we retired to a cave or a cloister and played ostrich, we would only be fooling ourselves that we are keeping away from it. Because, as you know, from our considerations throughout this year and the last 2 months of the last year, the psyche is not something which is exclusive to us as individuals. The psyche certainly distinguishes each person from another. But just as the body is composed of matter which comes out of the world stock of matter, so too, and even more so than the body, the psyche, though distinctive of us, is interrelated with the whole general psyche of the world. It has been one of the profoundest mistakes, quite natural because we had no option in the matter in past ages. It has been nevertheless one of the profoundest mistakes which we have made through the ages in imagining that what we think or feel is exclusively our own. Whatsoever we feel or think affects not only us, ourselves, it affects the whole world. The functioning of the psyche we might compare to a tide which spreads over the world. But a tide takes time, whereas it is more than likely that the psychical effects which we generate and which we receive from others act instantaneously throughout all space. We know how sensitive people, that is to say, certain sensitive people, are able to be aware suddenly of what is happening or what someone else is thinking at the other end of the world. And the times are coincident when this happens. We must awake to the fact, really awake to it inwardly, that the world is one whole world, that mankind is one mankind. Not only mankind, but the totality is truly one totality. We do not live unto ourselves. We cannot live unto ourselves alone if we wish to. We have to take responsibility. And we have to make our right contribution in response, not in helpless, uncontrollable reaction to all that happens in the world. This particular tragedy is so poignant because it has invaded a field of human activity, of humane expression, in which the brotherhood of man was one of the dominant keynotes. Even this was not sacrosanct. We have had murders in cathedrals. You know the classic instance, Thomas a Becket, to mention only one instance. But now, in the field of sport, of young people meeting together, ostensibly without any distinction of creed or class or race or sex or anything, in the spirit of one humanity, even in that field, violence has cast its ugly shadow. We say that we are concerned with living the holy life, the religious life. As we have seen again and again in our meetings, the religious life is not separate from the whole of life. The religious life is intimately associated with the totality, with the whole of life. The religious life means that this element of, or shall I say, characteristic of religiousness, which distinguishes the human race is emerging in its, or trying to emerge in its fullness, so that it affects the totality of our being and the totality of our activity. Then, when that happens, we shall be truly a human race, truly distinguishable from all other animal species. Now, when I say that we must learn to respond in the right way to everything, we must see clearly the necessity for experiencing life with great sensitivity. We tend to shut out things. We want to shut out this, that, and the other which is unpleasant. Oh, it's too awful to think about. I can't bear it. It upsets me. Yes, it upsets me. But if I say I can't bear it, surely to that extent I am not fully human. The body can be killed, it can be hurt and killed. The psyche can be hurt, but as long as the organism is alive, the psyche is unkillable. As long as the body is alive, and some essential parts of it, such as the brain, or some of the very important glands, are not hurt beyond repair, any hurt to the psyche is cured just like that, quite easily. It is a case of awakening to the reality of our actual nature. Remember this. This violence which we see mounting up as an uncontrollable fury now in our world is very much greater in scale than in past ages, simply because in the past we hadn't the means and there weren't the conditions for this quantitative increase. Take, for instance, the fact of modern communication. All the world knows what is happening. And the result is that all the world reacts with this, that, or the other feeling or thought. Therefore, the psychical atmosphere gets supercharged with psychical energy. In the past, if one didn't hear certain things, one didn't hear very much beyond one's village or town or county or country even, then the stimulus to each one of us was not so powerful, and there weren't so many stimuli. But because of this welter of news which floods the world, all the world knows it, and all the world reacts to it. This is one of the natural consequences of what we call progress in invention, industry, and all the rest of it. But the qualitative aspect today is no different from the qualitative aspect of the past. The quantitative aspect is different. It has increased. That's what's happening in every department of life. The quantitative aspect is mounting up and up and up. That's why a disaster today is so much more enormous, so terrifying as compared with a disaster in the past. But the qualitative aspect is no different. We tend to think of the past in somewhat glamorous terms. We always look back to the past with nostalgia. Oh, the good old days. Oh, the golden age of this, that, or the other country or civilization and so forth. Let us consider only one example. We talk in relation to India of the golden age of the Upanishads and the Buddha. A wonderful period it must have been, and then about 3 centuries later, the birth and the reign of the great and good Emperor Ashoka. We have handed down to us as history only the pleasant tidbits. Have we ever looked deeply, critically into the actual prevailing conditions in those days? That we don't. There is just perhaps a passing statement also in the history books telling us of some of the difficulties of those days. Let me read you something from the so-called gradual sayings, the Anguttara Nikaya of the Buddhists. The Buddha himself, in a discourse, talks about all this. He mentions the different punishments that are meted out to criminals, to robbers, adulterers, and so forth. In this connection, monks, he says, one sees rulers seize a robber, a miscreant, and subjecting him to diverse forms of punishment, flogging him, cutting off his hand, his foot, or a hand and a foot, or his nose or ear, or the nose and ear, torturing him with the gruel pot. Now, this gruel pot torture was simply this. They took off the top of the skull and, taking a red-hot iron ball with pincers, dropped it in so that the brains boiled over. This, remember, was contemporary with the Buddha's lifetime. They torture him with the chank shave, as it is called. That is, sandpapering the scalp with gravel till it was as smooth as a seashell. These were the people who were the heirs of that supreme height of spiritual insight represented in the Upanishads. This is how the people lived and behaved unto each other. Torturing him with Rahu's mouth. Rahu is the demon who was supposed to swallow the moon and cause its eclipse. And what they did was to open the culprit's mouth with a skewer and insert oil and a wick and light it. There are many more things which the Buddha mentions, but I won't harrow you with a detailed recital of it. You see, this is the kind of thing that happened. And this is not exclusive to India. These very same things I have read about China, for instance. These very same things have happened in all parts of the world throughout the ages. Man's cruelty to man. His senseless, brutal, murderous cruelty. Again, throughout the ages, there have arisen people who have felt this so deeply, so sensitively, that they have tried to counter it by introducing measures, laws, designed to get rid of cruelty. In our own history, frequently, one of the simplest examples quoted is William Wilberforce and the slave trade. How he was one of the biggest forces for the abolishment of slavery in America. Who started slavery in America? We did. Captain John Hawkins, particularly, was one of the earliest of the English pirates. He was nothing but a pirate, after all, in all such activities. Going over to Africa and suddenly taking these innocent men, women, and children, transporting them in horrible conditions to America to be sold as slaves for their lifetime. We know all about that. We have read it. Every one of us, for instance, I think, has read Uncle Tom's Cabin. And then, here in this very country, which started the slave trade, there arose William Wilberforce, who was instrumental in abolishing it by law. But consider how that works. Has it brought peace between white man and black man in America? Consider how the black man is coming into England now, has come into England, and how his presence is giving rise to problems. The material problems could be dealt with fairly easily, but the psychological problems are the problems which defeat us and will continue to defeat us. The hatred, the violence in the mind and the heart, the feeling of revenge, the feeling of a downtrodden people wanting to satisfy its ego and assert itself triumphantly over the oppressor. And how is this feeling of oppression carried through in human beings? Through memory, which is a psychical phenomenon. It's not a physical phenomenon. Through memory. So you see, the external way is almost a futile way, the physical way. We may pass race relations acts and do all sorts of things like that. But what is in the mind and the heart of man, and the way my psyche and your psyche react to the situation, that is the most powerful determining factor. Wilberforce was instrumental in removing slavery in America because he considered that as an example of Christian duty, Christian ethic. But was this an utterly pure and a real thing in his psyche, or was it an intellectualist idealism with the subtle satisfaction of ego at the back of it? I am a good Christian. You see, we never, almost never, get at the root of the thing. We are so conditioned. We are so self-centered, so self-oriented, so full of self-esteem. This amour propre, that we do all kinds of things, what are commonly called good as well as what are called bad, to bolster up this ego, this isolated ego, isolated in our own consciousness from other human beings. And then we talk of love and charity. We will put our hands in our pockets and dole out money by the million for the sake of the suffering poor. I'll do that, and I myself will be the root source of producing the suffering poor. But I don't do anything about extirpating that root of ill in myself. You see, we have to consider this very deeply. Consider it. That means not just think about it, not just talk about it, not just go rushing about becoming a member of this society for doing good and that society for alleviating misery and so forth. To consider is something so deep, so whole, that practically no one in the world is capable of such consideration. Only the truly holy one is capable of full, complete, true consideration. Consider. Con, together with. And sidus, sideris. Sideris is the genitive case. A star. What is a star? A star is a self-shining light. It doesn't reflect light. It is a self-shining light. To consider means essentially to look intently into light, to be lighted up from within, enlightened from within. To be a flame of wisdom and love with no smoke in that flame. Now, to consider in that way implies the necessity to be totally sensitive all the time to everything. Totally sensitive to it. We mustn't be frightened that we'll be hurt beyond endurance. We won't be hurt beyond endurance. Except under unhappy or unusual circumstances. As I've said already, for instance, if there is damage to the brain or the glands or something like that. Otherwise, everything is within our power to absorb, to fully absorb everything that happens, everything that comes to us, and to be wholly sensitive to it, which means that the heart is totally open. If the heart is totally open, it's wholly vulnerable in the sense of being wholly impressible. If the heart is not wholly impressed, but some part is cut off, then it is not possible to be wholly wise, to be wholly right and good in the action which we do. So that is one aspect of this considering fully and deeply. There is another aspect, of course. This, the heart represents the warm aspect. There is the cool, balancing aspect, which enables one to remain poised, inwardly poised, whilst at the same time one is wholly absorbing and is wholly sensitive to everything. And that is that the intellect remains perfectly cool, perfectly calm. The eyes of the intellect are totally open and free of the limiting influence of all the conditioning that the intellect has undergone. The conditioning that the intellect undergoes from the time we are born and right through our life is all that we are told, all that we believe, all that we have not challenged, investigated, and fully understood. Though all that sort of thing is the conditioning of the intellect. And there is a terrible, unfortunate aspect to the intellect, of which we are hopelessly ignorant and take no notice of. The intellect, with the exception of the intellect of the purified ones, is the slave of desire, and desire is blind. What do we bend our intellectual gifts to? We wish for something. We get attracted by something. It may appear, and indeed it may, relatively speaking, be a noble, a sublime thing. And we say, ah, yes, now, let's think this out, let's plan it out, and let's do it. Beware. Let us not be in such a hurry to be God. There is only one that is good, said Jesus, and that is God. Why callest thou me good? Said by the sinless one, and therefore of infinite significance. Wasn't said by a mere genius or a brilliant psychologist or somebody. So you see what is entailed in living the holy life, the religious life. And this is only one tiny aspect of it. In relationship to this violence, this phenomenon of violence, which is engulfing the human race today, particularly since the last war. Everything seems to be erupting everywhere. Now, as we look at it, and look at it sensitively with the heart, wholly sensitively, and with complete calm and poise, and clear-sightedness with the intellect. As we consider it that way, then, if we remain poised, two things mainly happen. One is that we come to know ourselves as we never knew ourselves before, and become increasingly released from our conditioning. All our falsities and our incapacities and stupidities, our fears, our ignorance, and all the rest of it. That takes place on the one hand. On the other hand, what we commonly describe as the right course of action emerges. You see, if we look into our own lives, I'm talking just about ourselves, people like ourselves. If we look into our own lives, don't we notice that time and again we are just suddenly caught? Something, the impulse, this is good, I'll do this. Mind you, I'm talking of the good side, a good impulse. But it has not been considered wholly and fully. And therefore, we hurt Tom, Dick and Harry in the process of doing good. And then we get appalled at ourselves. Good heavens, I thought I was doing something which would help him. And look what I have done to him. Doesn't this happen again and again in our lives? We slip up here and there and everywhere. Why? Because we have not been wide awake, wholly attentive, truly considerate. We mustn't accuse ourselves or try to excuse ourselves. Of course, there are excellent reasons why the thing happens. Our task is to understand, to discover and understand the reasons. How did this thing happen? What went wrong? But in order to discover the truth of it, bear in mind that always the intellect has to be calm and balanced, very clearly observing all the forces, not merely the external forces, but the forces here and here, in the head and the heart, which have been operating. The intellect has to be like that, and the heart has to be very sensitive, alert. This alertness of the heart, this tremendous sensitivity, is one of the meanings of the phrase, the fear of the Lord. You find that same idea expressed in the Upanishads. For fear of Brahman, Vayu, the god of wind, as the populace says, Vayu blows. for fear of him, Agni, the god of fire, as the populace says, burns, and so forth. It's a strange phrase, but don't look at it merely intellectualistically. Understand it. This fear is this extraordinarily alert sensitivity. It's a quivering thing. In that sense, it's the fear of the Lord. You remember some months ago, or maybe last year, this fear of the Lord is the kind of fear which is felt when love approaches its consummative union. Then there is this same extraordinary, God, what's this? The magic is so terrific. It's not the ordinary cowardly turn tail and run for your life fear. It's not that. It's this. This profound, deep sensitivity. Otherwise, if that were not there, one becomes guilty of irreverence. One is brash and egoistically assertive. One is only concerned with overpowering the object of love and bending it to one's own will. You see? It's like that. So, consider in this deep, profound way, all the time. And not only do we learn about ourselves, and insofar as we become truly acquainted with ourselves, we understand our neighbor, whosoever he may be. That on the one hand, and on the other hand, the right course of action will spontaneously emerge and make itself known to you. You see the importance of this. There is nothing which is predetermined in accordance with our particular preconceptions and assumptions, our biases and prejudices. Remember what I have said for the last 40 years at least. All our assumptions and preconceptions have no warrant in truth. In ultimate truth, all these fade away. They all vanish away. And you discover that this assumption or preconception, which means a fixed mental shape, has no validity. It is a tomb. It is a block to the free flow of eternal life, life abundant, which is perpetually creative in the immediate now. And who am I, a little human creature, to presume to know the totality of the immediate now, that I should form preconceptions or assumptions about it at all? You see now why in the disciplinary processes of all the great religions we are told to relinquish, not to grasp, every thought and feeling as it arises, every idea, every formulated teaching, and so forth. It comes to you, it comes within your purview, examine it, look at it, understand it, experience it, and let go the husk. If I am hungry and you present me with a delicious dinner on the plate, do I just say, ah, this is a delicious dinner, now I'll keep it like that for the rest of my days? what will happen to my insides, which want to eat it and digest it? And that dinner as such, the shape, the form, absolutely disappears, undergoes complete chemical transformation. It's here the analogy applies almost 100%. It's the same with teachings, thoughts, ideas, systems of philosophy, psychology, or whatever it is. You see, thus we live humanly. And living humanly, we are able to understand, to absorb, and make the right response to this horror of violence which is engulfing the world. Never ask another person, what am I to do now then? Tell me, what shall I do in order to stem the violence? I have said exactly what to do. Consider within yourselves and understand, and out of your own self will emerge the course of action which is right for you and which only you can do and nobody else can. And it wouldn't apply to anybody else. The other person's course of action will be different. This is a living thing, a living process. Violence is a manifestation, an ugly, hurtful, cruel, horrible manifestation of my own psychical living process. If I learn how to live in my soul, just as I more or less know how to live as far as the body is concerned, I eat, drink, sleep, rest, etc., which keeps the bodily living process going. It's the same with the psyche. Now, let us look at some of the things which have been taught in the past which indicate to us what it is, what it means to be free of impurity, to be free of limitations within ourselves. I'll read just a little bit about it. This is a very interesting discourse by a bhikkhu, a monk called Bakkula. This is Buddhistic. A man called Kassapa, who is following another discipline, comes to Bakkula and he asks, how long is it since you, Reverend Bakkula, went forth? And he answers, it must be 80 years, friend, since I went forth. Went forth means went from the home life in the home into the homeless life of the hermit. And how many times during these 80 years have you, Reverend Bakkula, indulged in sexual intercourse? Kassapa asks. Friend Kassapa, you should not question me thus. And how many times during these 80 years have you indulged in sexual intercourse? But you could question me thus. And how many times during these 80 years did perceptions of sensual pleasure rise in you? You see the wisdom of Bakkula in telling Kassapa, this is the way you should formulate the question. Because formulated this way, it includes the entire field of sense experience. That's the whole point about it. And he calls it perceptions of sensual pleasure. So Kassapa says, asks the question in that form, and how many times during these 8 years did perceptions of sensual pleasure rise in you? And Bakula answers, during the 80 years that I have gone forth, friend Kassapa, I am not aware of any perception of sensual pleasure rising in me. Now, of course, one may feel a bit impatient and say, oh, this is nonsense. I don't believe it. But that is hardly the sensible approach. It's not a question of believing it, believing what is said or not believing what is said. Consider it. Let the mind be quiet, free of its conditionings, its preconception, its assumption, its biases, its prejudices. So-and-so teaches in modern times that to repress your emotions leads to neuroses and psychosis. Yes, yes, we know all that. But leave all that alone, consider it. In 80 years, I have not been aware of any perception of sensual pleasures rising in me. Its tremendous significance and its multitudinous implications. And then he goes on in the same way with regard to I am not aware of any perception of malevolence or any perception of harming rising in me. So you see, lust or greed, if you like, hate, delusion, and all the rest of it are allayed in oneself. This is its meaning. This state of purity is part of the living of the holy life. Now, if we consider this, we will awake to the full extent of what it means to live the holy life. And you see, this which we call the simple moralities, or if you like the theistic formulations, what are called the commandments and all that, this is the sort of thing that it implies. We have occasionally talked about honor thy father and mother and its significances. And they are simply tremendous. We haven't begun to know what honor thy father and mother means. We merely think of mum and dad. Yes, mum and dad are the first thing we know in connection with the terms father and mother, and that we must honor them. Nowadays, of course, we throw all that out of the window. And the result is our spiritual starvation by throwing that out of the window. So he goes on and speaks about the various things that constitute just the one aspect of purity. Now let us turn to something else. We have been considering this question of violence. Now see how love is exemplified. There is a bhikkhu called Punna who is given a very short statement by the Buddha. All that the Buddha does, I'll say what Punna asks. He says, it would be good if the Lord would exhort me with an exhortation in brief, so that I, having heard Dhamma from the Lord, might abide alone, aloof, diligent, ardent, self-resolute, in order to practice the holy life. Well then, said the Lord, listen, attend carefully, and I will speak. There are, Punna, material shapes cognizable by the eye, agreeable, pleasant, light, enticing, connected with sensual pleasures, alluring. If a monk delights in these, welcomes them, and persists in cleaving to them, then because he delights in them, welcomes them, and persists in cleaving to them, delight uprises in him. Pleasure. I say that from the uprising of delight is the uprising of anguish. Then he repeats the same for sounds heard by the ear, tastes tasted by the tongue, and so forth. And he repeats the same thing. That whatsoever, the point being that whatsoever produces the uprising of delight means also the uprising of anguish, brings about the uprising of anguish. Then Punna says, there is a district called Sunaparanta. I will stay there, revered sir, now that I have been exhorted by the Lord with the exhortation in brief. And the Lord tells him, Punna, the people of Sunaparanta are fierce. They are rough. If the people of Sunaparanta revile and abuse you, how will it be for you there, Punna? If the people of Sunaparanta revile and abuse me, revered sir, I will say, goodly indeed are these people of Sunaparanta, very goodly, in that they do not strike me a blow with their hands. It will be thus for me here, Lord, it will be thus for me, welfarer. But if the people of Sunaparanta do strike you a blow, then Punna answers, goodly indeed are the people of Sunaparanta, very goodly, in that they do not strike me a blow with clods of earth. And so he goes on, you know, I won't bore you with the details, and he ends up by saying, the Buddha says, but if the people of Sunaparanta do deprive you of life with a sharp knife, and Punna answers, if the people of Sunaparanta deprive me of life with a sharp knife, it will be for me there, I will say, there are disciples of the Lord who, disgusted by the body and the life principle and ashamed of them, looked about for a knife with which to kill themselves. I have come upon this very knife without having looked for it. It will thus be for me, Lord, it will thus be for me. But you see the point. No enmity or hate arises in Punna. Whatsoever happens, no question of honor, justice, freedom, etc., to be fought for or defended or teaching the other fellow a lesson. Nothing of that. Look at the... Consider... Be wholly sensitive to what Punna is, therefore. The very embodiment of love. And it is only through such a psyche that transcendent love and wisdom can function freely. And if we are like that, are we not truly human beings, the instruments for the manifestation by the one total reality of this transcendence, which can take place only through the human kingdom and not through any other creature or tree or stone or anything. You see the extraordinary significance of it all. And you see the intensity of it, the enormity of it. Just one more. This is the famous discourse which is called the parable of the saw, the carpenter's saw. It comes at the end of the discourse. Herein, monks, in answer to anybody who speaks roughly and harshly to you, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell with a mind of friendliness, void of hatred, totally and completely void of hatred. And we will dwell having suffused that man who spoke harshly and rudely to us with a mind of friendliness. And beginning with him, we will dwell having suffused the whole world with a mind of friendliness which is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. This is how you must train yourselves, monks. And now, monks, even if low-down thieves might carve you one limb from another with a double-handled saw, yet even then, whoever sets his mind at enmity, he, for this reason, is not a doer of my teaching. Herein, monks, you should train yourselves thus. Neither will our minds become perverted, nor will we utter an evil speech, but kindly and compassionate will we dwell with a mind of friendliness void of hatred. And beginning with him, suffuse the whole world with a mind of friendliness that is far-reaching, widespread, immeasurable, without enmity, without malevolence. You see where all this reaches out into the field of justice, the field of human relations, international law. Everything comes under this. And you see that living the holy life means living by the values which do not belong to the dualistic sphere, but values which are transcendent, which are absolute values. This is our difficulty. I am but a poor creature, caught up in the toils of dualism, in the prisoner of my separative self-consciousness, clinging to ego, clinging to the preservation of the self which in actual fact is continuously perishing. Because I am like this, the task is so difficult. But if you and I are really concerned with the religious life, then instead of wasting time and energy upon the way in which the world, the people of the world, try to solve all the difficulties and problems which the world presents them, we were to consider this and realize our full humanity, we shall have made the supreme contribution to the solution of the problems of the world.